Greetings, everyone. This is Bill Olver, Managing Editor of PubK. It's just after 12 o'clock, and we're going to begin our webinar, COVID-19 Cost Recovery for Government Contractors. In this uncertain time, contractors and NGOs lack clear legal guidelines regarding the recovery of cost impacts from the COVID-19 pandemic. Today, PubK is pleased to host a panel of experts from Nichols Liu LLP, who will discuss the rapidly evolving legal authorities in this area and the practical steps that contractors can take to seek recovery of these costs through invoicing and requests for equitable adjustment. We'll also discuss how you can prepare for audits and investigations of these costs in the future. Now, you will have the option to submit questions to the panel during the session. You should see a Q&A box on your screen. Simply click that and enter your question. However, I will warn you, our panel has a lot of material to cover in the next hour, so it's possible we will not be able to address questions during the session. However, we will capture these questions and we'll address them in a follow-up to all participants. And with that, I will turn things over to our panel. It's my pleasure to first introduce Andy Liu, co-founder and partner of Nichols Liu, to start things off. So take it away, Andy.
Thank you, Bill, and thanks to PubK for hosting this webinar. And thanks to everybody for joining us today. First and foremost, I want to just say I hope that all of you are healthy and safe and managing as best as can be in these difficult times. As Bill said, I'm a partner with Nichols Liu. I'm just going to kick things off today. My practice focuses on government contracts related litigation, compliance, government investigations, and False Claims Act defense. And I'm joined today by four of my colleagues. And in the interest of time, I'm going to keep their intro similarly brief. But at the end of the slide deck, which will be circulated, we have our contact information on there. So with me today, first, is Robert Nichols. He left Covington and Burling, where he co-chaired the government contracts group there to co-found Nichols Liu. And he spent his entire career representing government contractors and NGOs in just about everything from claims and protests to suspension and debarment, investigations and tort claims against the government. Next up, I am thrilled to introduce to you today David Bodenheimer, who has reunited with me and Robert about a month ago, as the three of us were previously partners together at Kroll & Moring. David is a government contracts litigator through and through. He's been recognized by Chambers as the top expert on defective pricing. He is a great cost and pricing attorney, and he literally wrote the book on defective pricing. Also with us today is Annie Kim, who is a special counsel with our firm, and she is a former special agent with USAID and the Department of Energy OIG offices. She has about 10 years of experience with criminal and civil false claims investigations, coming with both the government and defense perspectives. And then last but not least, we have Adrian Wigsden, who is an investigator and cost accountant with us. He's a former DCAA auditor and OIG auditor with the Departments of Energy and Veterans Affairs. And he has extensive experience with incurred cost audit and performance audits. So again, thank you for joining us. We have a lot to cover in an hour today. Robert, if you don't mind advancing to the agenda. So here's our agenda. We're gonna spend the most of our time on two of these topics, the primary government decrees that have come out that bear on cost recovery, and on some of our practical tips for cost recovery. We do expect that, you know, with this huge influx of government funds to fight the pandemic and to stimulate the economy, there's going to be the inevitable years of government audits and investigations to ensure that the funds were used properly. So we will spend a few minutes discussing how best to prepare for them. And then we'll also briefly discuss a draft memorandum that our firm, along with others, have been working on that we hope to present to OMB very shortly. So obviously, we're all kind of living through these challenges created by the pandemic. For those of you who live in the DC area, you know that the entire DMV, DC, Virginia, Maryland, all imposed stay-at-home orders. My public service announcement for the day is for everybody to wash their hands, practice social distancing, and abide by your state's orders. So we all know all too well what the disruption has been to our lives on a daily basis, but it's obviously also disrupted government contracting. And listed here on this slide are just some of the impacts. I'm not gonna read them all. You know, some of these are felt more immediately, like decreased productivity, which, you know, obviously leads to lower labor billing. And some of these are, you know, going to be felt longer term, like higher overhead rates or eventual default terminations. And so all of these issues raise a lot of questions. And the government has put out some guidance that addresses the issues, but it still leaves a lot of the questions either unanswered or just unclear. And so we're going to talk a little bit about the guidance that has come out, some of which has just come out in the last day. And then we'll provide some tips on how to proceed given this kind of murky landscape. And without further delay, I'm just going to turn it right over to Robert to talk about the first of the government decrees we're going to cover.
Thanks, Andy. So as everybody knows, there is a lot coming out. The government is issuing decrees daily. Unfortunately, they are taking an agency-by-agency approach for the most part. There has been little coming out of OFPP, and unfortunately, a lot of it is in the form of guidance, not directives. And as all of you know, directives often entitle you to more money. Guidance doesn't necessarily. And so we're going to go through some of the decrees that have come out and talk about what they say. But we also want to point out that PubK has here a resource center that has been started that is collecting all of the government decrees that come out and blog posts from all of the leading law firms and accounting firms in these areas to put in one place everything that might be important. Breaks down by contract, federal decrees, fraud and cyber, indemnification, shutdowns, state decrees. We're also going to be adding an FAQ section later today that our law firm is going to be sponsoring. So this is something that is free to the public and hopefully will be beneficial to everybody. The first decree I want to focus on came out from the Corps of Engineers about a week and a half ago. And I want to focus on it because to me, it is exactly what the government should not be doing. What this essentially says is that we may be shutting down sites. And if we do shut down sites and people aren't able to work, we may consider it to be an act of the sovereign. So we don't have to issue stop work orders. And so we don't have to pay for idle employees. I think that this is a very bad policy because the government has spent an enormous amount of time making its agencies rely on contractors and NGOs. And the idea that the government may try to stand behind using legal tools by labeling this one thing versus another, I find troubling. I find it to be a bad policy. And one of the things that we're going to talk about at the end of this is what we're calling the ideal OMB memo. One that would bring together a number of tools to keep contractors performing and to keep the contractor industrial base intact. And it's a paper that we put together that we're pushing to OMB through a number of different outlets. So that's the first piece of guidance from the Corps of Engineers. The second is the CARES Act, Section 3610. This was passed, as everybody knows, on Friday. And it deals essentially with DoD contractors. One of the things that we found is that certain industries have been better at lobbying the government for what they need. And this is something that we noticed immediately when the airlines went in and asked for tens of billions of dollars. They're really on top of asking the government for relief. Well, not surprisingly, DoD contractors are among the most organized as well. And NDIA, in particular, the National Defense Industry Association, helped get this provision in place. And what it does is it says, contractors, we need you to stay in a ready state. We need you to keep working as much as you can. But if you can't keep working, contractors are authorized under flexibly priced contracts to give leave and to submit those, continue submitting those costs for people on paid leave to the government, and the government is to pay them. If you don't have a flexibly priced contract, you can do this under fixed price contracts and seek an equitable adjustment. But there are conditions. The employees must be unable to perform the work at their regular place of performance, which the government approves through the FAR, and there has to be a facility closure in place. And the people must not be able to telework. If they can telework at home, you need to mitigate their lack of productivity by doing that. Interestingly, this idea of what government facilities are covered by this is a little bit vague. We would argue that it applies to any facilities that the government has approved, including if they're not government-owned facilities. But there's some ambiguity on that. So how does this come up? If a manufacturing facility is closed or if a professional employee is not able to work, we would argue that the fallback is to resort to telework. And if telework doesn't work, put them on leave, call it sick leave or whatever you want, COVID-19 leave, and pay them at an amount that will be reimbursable, the minimum applicable billing rates, and they're not to exceed 40 hours per week. So this suggests a price-based rather than a cost-based reimbursement, and I think this is an important distinction. Rather than saying, tell us what cost you're incurring for salaries and benefits, what they're saying is, put in place the, continue billing us for the minimum legal contract billing rates. So that's an important feature of 3610, and we're going to talk about the implications of that a little bit more for where 3610 doesn't apply. But continuing with 3610, this is one of the areas where I'm troubled. This is discretionary. In other words, the agencies that are covered by 3610 have the discretion to put it in place, but they're not required to. This is something that I think we're seeing across government decrees. They're written in the permissive so that if an agency decides to invoke it, they can. I think that's actually unhelpful. I think there ought to be clear direction coming out from Congress and OMB with regard to what agencies they're supposed to do, so there's more uniformity and less questions in the minds of people. But for now, 3610 is written the way it is. Contractors also don't have to give consideration for this to happen. It can happen automatically if the government agrees to it. The government puts some time frames around this. It has to end by September 30th, although we all know that could change as things progress. Interestingly, this also says, notwithstanding any other provision of law, which we interpret as being the cost principles, these leave costs will be allowable. So there won't be fights over allowability later, assuming that all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed and there's no fraud baked in. But I believe that you're also going to have to demonstrate that you all attempted to telework to the maximum extent practicable. We'll talk about that a little bit more as well. Importantly, agencies can use any appropriated funds that they have. It doesn't need to be just the specific procurement that they've been relying on. And I also think that what we're going to find is if they run out of appropriations, there will be a way to resort to the judgment fund if that were to happen. And importantly, this also applies both to contracts and to other types of agreements, cooperative agreements, grants, et cetera. And this is an important distinction because, as everybody knows, grant numbers in terms of dollars can dwarf contracts. But a lot of the guidance that's been coming out is for contracts. This one makes clear that it applies beyond contracts. I'm going to move to a DoD memo that actually just came out this morning. Another memo that is somewhat helpful, but not great. What it says is that during and after the emergency, contracting officers must work closely with contractors to keep the defense industrial base intact for our national security. Good policy statement. I completely agree with it. I think that this should be actually put out by OMB and go way beyond the defense industrial base, but this is what's happening with the splintering of the guidance. It then goes on to essentially say all of the standard rules apply. Where the contracting officer directs changes, there may be an equitable adjustment under the standard FAR clauses, and that may be for cost or schedule. Unfortunately, it then goes on to say that equitable adjustments must be treated on a case-by-case basis. I actually believe that this is going to clog the government operations up so much. Part of what you're going to see in our ideal memo is, REAs go in, but there's a presumption of allowability so long as you meet certain standards. And we're not seeing that yet, where the government concedes that, you know, doing one-off REAs is just going to be impossible. It does say that the government has to take into account several factors, allowable, allocable, reasonable, not surprising there. And of course, this COVID-19 issue can cause excusable delays that should not affect your contractor ratings. The next memo is on critical infrastructure sector, and I believe, David, you're handling this, right?
I think that's right. David, are you on mute?
Well, why don't I jump in?
I'm sorry, can you hear me, Robert?
Yes, go ahead, David.
Things are moving so fast that even the mute button is running behind. So thank you, Robert. With respect to these two memos, I'll spend most of my time on the Department of Homeland Security memo and the DOD memo, a little bit less on the next slide and less on the final slide. But looking at these two particular memos, the first one, the Krebs memo, is from Department of Homeland Security, Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency. There's a number of helpful things in this particular memo. First, it broadly defines critical infrastructure. If you are a government contractor, there is a very high likelihood that you are part of the critical infrastructure workforce. In particular, it includes the defense industrial base as part of critical infrastructure, which covers the vast majority of procurement dollars. But more importantly, for the rest of the agencies, it covers healthcare, agriculture, energy, transportation, logistics, communications, you know, the IT business, critical manufacturing. So as you can see, the vast portion of the government contractors would fall within the definition of critical infrastructure under this memo. On the less helpful side, the memo expressly states that it is advisory. It's not authoritative. In addition, it defers to the state and local jurisdictions for primary guidance and tells them to use their own judgment. So your ability to use this in the course of cost claims is not as strong as the next one I will discuss. But before I move to the DOD Undersecretary's memo, the DHS memo does expressly state that it encourages remote working wherever possible. So for a policy statement, that may be helpful to you. Now let's turn to the Department of Defense Ellen Lord memo. As nearly all of you know, she is the Undersecretary of Defense. There are a lot of very helpful statements here. Let's start with the first. The Secretary of Defense is the mother of all contracting officers for the entire defense business. That means the Undersecretary, speaking for the Secretary, does have the authority to make dictates on acquisition authority. Here, first, the Lord memo states that the defense industrial base is critical infrastructure, and that is broadly defined. So if you don't fall within research and development, design, production, delivery, maintenance, services, and so on, that's a very small portion of defense contractors. It would be hard to conceive of those that are not covered. Second, the memo also expressly states that the critical infrastructure workforce includes personnel working for companies and their subcontractors who perform under contract to the Department of Defense, providing materials and services. So that tells you, if you're a defense contractor, almost certainly you are covered by this memo. There are a few minor exceptions, such as recreational support, office supplies, and lawn care. I don't think many of you on this call fall into any of those categories. So you should start with the presumption that you, as a defense contractor, are critical infrastructure workforce. What does that mean for you? From the president's own guidelines, if you work in critical infrastructure industry, you have a special responsibility to maintain your normal work schedule. This memo is telling you, to the maximum extent possible, keep on working. Keep on working to your pre-COVID-19 work schedule. As a practical matter for claims, it would be reasonable to treat this as an order from the highest levels of the Pentagon telling you to keep working. If somebody tells you that you should stop working, send them the Lord memo. If somebody tells you that you should meet your original delivery schedule, notwithstanding all the problems, that is effectively a constructive acceleration, given this order to all of the defense contractors to keep on working to your normal schedule. So this should be a valuable tool in your claim toolbox. Keep it on top, and whenever you start running into the difficulties in meeting schedule, move on. The next memo relates to submission of interim vouchers under classified contracts. Here, the good news is that it should speed up the process. You should get payments faster. In addition, it clears out some of the upfront impediments to getting your vouchers paid. The flip side of this, however, is sufficient documentation is still going to be required. If you don't do it upfront with your interim voucher, you're going to have to reconstruct it later because DCAA is going to question the voucher later on. Second, it also suggests deferred paying. By taking the contracting officers out of the process, they are more likely to raise questions down the road. So whatever is not cleared out upfront when you submit your voucher, you're going to run into a problem. Finally, the bottom line, a lot of this Robert has already discussed. I think the bottom line here is there's not a lot of guidance. You need to jump in on protecting yourself, documenting your claims, and tracking your costs. And Robert is going to be discussing that in the next slides on practical tips.
Thanks, David. So on Friday, our firm convened about 30 CEOs and CFOs and general counsels to create a mind map around COVID-19 costs and to figure out what are the costs going to be and how do we actually get them covered under current authorities, and what additional authorities and direction would be nice to have. And so what we're going to present now is a readout of that brainstorming session, along with the follow-on brainstorming session that we convened of a bunch of leading government contracts lawyers in the industry to say, now that we're hearing from our clients what cost concerns they have, let's talk for a minute about how they recover them. I do want to go back for just a second to this earlier slide about the cost impacts. We break down the cost impacts and the questions as follows. I believe everybody's going to have decreased productivity. And what that means is, where the rubber hits the road is, can we bill time for our people when they are either not working or where they are less productive than they would normally be? And this comes into play because you have to figure out, can you bill their labor hours? Well, if they're not working, is the government going to ding you for billing their labor hours? Or if their productivity is actually slower and it's going to take more time and effort to complete and more cost to complete, can we actually get paid more under those contracts? We've already talked about the possibility of default terminations if you're not on time, but I think that there are two other major considerations that are worth talking about. On cost type contracts, what if you're bumping up against the contract caps, cost caps, or the indirect rate ceilings? We think we're going to talk about how to address those things, or if you're bumping up against your fixed price on your fixed price contract. And then there's also something that really we heard from the CFOs on. If we have decreased labor billings, that means that our provisional overhead rates that are tied to labor billings are going to be way off. We're not going to be absorbing all the overhead we would if the denominator, the labor billings, were what we expected it to be. So how do we actually capture more of that overhead? And we're going to talk about all these things. And then, of course, there are other procedural questions. Is the government going to continue paying invoices on time? What costs will be covered? Which ones won't be? And will this be an ad hoc system or somehow a systematic approach to paying costs, even if audited later, that makes sure the cost gets out, costs are covered and reimbursed and payments get out in a timely way? So this piece, this slide right here, I think is the heart of what everybody's really worried about. So now let's go down to our practical tips. And these come from, as I said, the brainstorming sessions that we had with first a bunch of CEOs and CFOs and then a bunch of government contracts lawyers. So the first one is to take measures to mitigate your cost risk. And this is partly intuitive, but we can't overemphasize the importance of this. Taking steps now to memorialize everything for audits later, I guarantee you, is going to save companies an enormous amount of money and headaches. The first part is to actually contemporaneously identify and memorialize the actual impacts on your performance, your workforce, your schedule, and your costs. These can be memos to the file. They need to be as thorough as possible to help explain the situation. Second, mitigate through teleworking as much as possible, which I think a lot of organizations are doing. And some organizations are doing it fairly effectively. Others, you know, for example, factory work is much, much harder to do. But mitigating is important. Also, assigning personnel to other productive projects. The government, I believe, is going to expect you to take the same measures you would if they actually issued a stop work order. And as you know, a stop work order essentially says, we're directing you to stop work, which means that you need to mitigate your cost to the extent possible. And if you have idle labor that you can work on other projects, then go ahead and have them do that so that they're being paid from another source. We also want you to document your telework decisions, including who's doing what and why. And we want you to talk with your subcontractors. Subcontractors are going to need to know what to do as well. And slowing this down is going to save them a lot of headaches, but it's also going to save prime contractors a lot of headaches so that they do not have to be as worried about their subcontractors not knowing what to do and it being sort of a free-for-all later on. We also think it's wise to document any government directives that you receive, particular to your contracts, but also government directives and guidance that you rely on for how you're doing business. And again, it would be good if the government decrees were in the form of directives and not guidance. But if you're essentially interpreting guidance as direction to your company, memorialize that as well. Andy points out that I did miss one decree earlier that I'm going to just pop back up to. I did catch that. So no problem there. Okay, let's move on to the next set of practical tips, and that is tracking costs. And I believe Adrian's taking this, right?
Yeah, thanks, Robert. And I just want to step back and reiterate a couple important points that Robert just mentioned. And one thing to take in mind as a backdrop to what we're about to discuss is that the mere fact that there's a pandemic happening doesn't earn us a gold star or a fat check off the bat, right? We have to demonstrate these actual costs and the proximate cause from COVID to show that COVID is truly having an impact on our contract performance and our schedule and our costs. So that's really important in this context. And that's a big reason why we're documenting all of these important steps that Robert just mentioned. His discussion about mitigating and identifying alternate forms of performing under the contract is really important. With subcontractors, you know, sometimes there's additional sources that can be used. Where we'll be able to step in and follow through with our deliverables. So as we step into the practical tips and we're looking at tracking these costs, we can't really reiterate how important it is to start to establish those charge numbers for tracking these costs separately now. A sound business practice is to set all of that up front so you're capable of segregating any added costs from COVID. If that data becomes reliable, it will be a valuable asset to you later if you ever wind up in any type of dispute. A key issue that we expect to see companies facing are, like Robert spoke about with indirect costs, we have employees that may be unable to work or have lost productivity. And the hours for all of those scenarios become a sizable cost when you're looking at salaries, wages, and the associated fringe benefits. When we start looking at alternate ways to perform, like I just talked about, we are incurring costs around special equipment for teleworking, maybe additional equipment for issues around safety, adequate security, firewalls, all of these that could come at an added cost that it's very important for us to track. We want to identify and quantify any of the delays and changes that disrupt contract performance and ensure, again, that those are tracked separately. Robert spoke at length about memorializing both the direction from the contracting officer and any other government direction that you receive to continue working despite the issues with COVID. David mentioned briefly constructive acceleration, which, as we'll see, can be a way to take what's normally a delay that could possibly just give a schedule relief and turn it into a means for some additional cost recovery. When we lose contracts, the indirect cost and the unabsorbed overhead can become a big issue, right? Anytime that we lose work, it invariably means that we have staff that are now spending less time working direct and are going to naturally end up charging more of their time to indirect costs. So that unabsorbed overhead becomes very important to track and keep in mind. And just like all of the direct costs that we've discussed, you can establish separate charge codes for a COVID indirect cost bucket as well, because that can become part of your request for equitable adjustment later. When we talk about delays and disruptions, a couple of important things to keep in mind are ensuring that we're aware that the delays are mostly for a relief and schedule, but under certain cases, they can constitute a change, giving you ability to add the costs. Robert, let's move on to the next slide. A huge takeaway today is to engage in constant communication with both your CO and any of the other government officials that you're discussing with. If you receive any instructions that constitute a change or delay, we want to immediately put the CO on notice that the government's direction has changed or disrupted our contract performance. If you foresee or anticipate likely delays, we want to proactively negotiate new deadlines and milestone dates that enable us to extend the period of performance. We're going to notify both of cost and schedule impacts. A lot of folks are being faced with teleworking, so we want to communicate and document those attempts to telework where possible and continue our work. Some things that may arise are lost ability to travel. We can seek other options to meet deliverables, like using conferencing tools or perhaps outsourcing meetings that require travel to maybe a subcontractor or an analyst that's on the ground. We want to document all those efforts to help to substantiate any cost recovery later. Expediting timing of payments comes to mind. We've seen a number of scenarios in some of the agency guidance that's come out. OSD issued a class deviation for progress payments that's increasing the amount that large and small businesses can recover via those progress payments. David discussed the DCA interim voucher process, where essentially classified contractors are provisionally approved without having to go through the normal voucher review. And when we're looking at expediting payments, we want to take in mind that when the government consistently makes payments based on your supporting documentation, that becomes a consistent practice that may help you later during cost recovery to show that your supporting documentation was adequate. In the past, we've seen clients that allowed payments to go unsettled for a long period of time. They were relying on verbal discussions with the government, thinking or assuming that costs were going to be squared up, only then later to get slapped with a multi-million dollar claim for unsupported invoice because they let these things slide. Looking to advanced agreements, Robert touched on indirect rates earlier and things like provisional billing rates. When we're faced with those issues with unabsorbed overhead and lost liquidity from being able to recover those indirect costs, we can look for an advanced agreement to modify our provisional billing rate and get that proactively adjusted so that we're minimizing those losses in real time. Another important step that you can take is a method of getting the contracting officer to confirm whether or not your interpretation of all the guidance and the directives that you are seeing is incorrect. And when I say incorrect, what we mean is you can articulate using written correspondence to the CO issues and showing what your interpretation of the contract terms or the guidance may be. Ask the government directly to indicate if your interpretation is incorrect. For example, you can show your telework policies, your leave policies, memorialize certain costs that you're incurring because of COVID, and confirm that these are indeed allowable expenses. If you ask the CO to confirm that your interpretation is incorrect, and then later you don't receive a meaningful response, in the event of a dispute, the courts may interpret that you followed a consistent practice. Along the same line of thinking, we'll talk shortly about requests for equitable adjustments and getting advanced agreements in those areas as well. Robert, could we go on to the next slide? Invoicing as normal follows the same line of thinking we're just discussing for expediting payments. We want to ensure that we're continuing our normal invoicing processes and getting costs paid timely. And again, it's not just a sound business practice for liquidity, but leaving any invoices in an unpaid status on the table can naturally increase the chance of any cost disallowances later. If we obtain approval and payment of those invoices based on our normal processes and underlying documentation, that helps to constitute that consistent practice that'll help us with cost recovery later. A key step, and this goes along the lines of segregating our costs now, we want to identify the COVID-19 costs separately as line items on our invoices. In a minute, we're going to hear from Annie about the likelihood and risk of audits and investigations. And naturally, a hot topic that's going to arise in those audits is allocability of costs. So wherever possible, if we can create these line items now that are invoiced separately for COVID impacts, that's going to become an asset later if we're looking at disputes and trying to identify where those costs belong in our contract portfolio. We can't say enough now about how important it is to set up these systems to be ready to do this consistently from the get-go. We're all talking about the possibility of recovering added costs. And before we get in a big kerfuffle about what that all entails, it's important to remember that while these costs may be allowable, we still have contract ceilings and funding limitations and cost share requirements that we have to keep in mind. Those all remain unchanged. So if we need to make room for any allowable added costs, let's be proactive, seek amendments where we need to adjust any cost ceilings that are becoming very limiting. Robert, let's step on to our request for equitable adjustment. I think that we saw a couple questions from the panel today about when the right time is to prepare requests for equitable adjustment and what the mechanism may be. We'll step back to the clauses for changes, and under both fixed price and cost reimbursement contracts, we have 30 days to assert our right to adjustment. We don't want to delay and miss any opportunities for cost recovery just because we're in a crisis. When we're submitting our request for equitable adjustment, we want to consider both the monetary and the non-monetary adjustments like schedule impacts and other delays as well. Robert walked us through some of the new pronouncements in Section 3610 of the CARES Act that talks about how requests for equitable adjustment may be treated. And while the guidance is generically saying that factors will be considered like whether the costs are allocable, allowable, and reasonable to protect the health and safety of employees, we need to remember that we have to go home today remembering that what's allocable, allowable, and reasonable can be very difficult to establish in a dispute. It's our job now to document everything we can throughout the process, demonstrate what actions we took to minimize costs, and therefore be able to maximize our ability to recover costs later.
Adrian, this is Robert. I just want to focus on one element, these non-monetary REAs. They can deal with costs as well as schedule. And what we mean by this is we often have situations where we don't know what the costs are going to be yet, but we do need to establish that the government's going to pay the costs. And so we often put in non-monetary REAs where we say, as a matter of contract interpretation, we believe these costs are allowable and will be paid under the contract. We would like to get an advanced agreement with you. And we would like, even if you're not going to enter an advanced agreement, for you to agree that these are allowable. Because if the government comes back and says, no, we're not going to pay those costs, and we believe that we have an entitlement to them, then you can immediately appeal that to a certified claim denial to the boards and have these things resolved. And we're going to talk about that process a little bit more in just a minute. But establishing what will be paid and won't be paid, unfortunately, if we don't get government-wide guidance, and it has to be done on an REA by REA basis, then trying to carve out what you think needs to be paid early is advisable. Adrian?
Yeah, that's exactly spot on. And getting those REAs in time allows us the flexibility to adjust them later and help recover those costs. And The Q&A, I know that we won't have time to address all the Q&A questions, but I did just noticed one question that's particularly on topic. Mary Beth asked, if we're suggesting that we establish COVID cost codes per project or per contract or just company-wide, I don't think we have quite that level of granular detail just yet. I think the important takeaway for you to go home with, or stay home with, I guess better said, is that you need to both direct and indirect. I think it's a little bit easier to visualize the direct costs that are impacting from some of these issues, facility shutdowns, travel limitations, inability to access key spaces, and those costs become a little more simple. But identifying a separate bucket for indirect costs from idle time might be a step that some people could miss. And I think that's a really important step to identify how your systems can handle.
So while we're on the topic of REAs, I'll direct one more question, and maybe this one is for Robert. One of our attendees has asked whether under Section 3610 to get equitable adjustment under a fixed price contract, do you have to still submit a request for equitable adjustment under the FAR changes clause?
For fixed price contracts, yes. For cost type contracts, no, unless you are looking to change the contract to increase your caps in some way.
Great, thanks. So we'll take more Q&A if time permits at the end. Now, why don't we shift to preparations for audits and investigations, and I'll turn it over to Annie.
Thanks, Andy. So it's probably clear from what people have discussed so far that it's best to cover yourself because the government's not going to look out for you in the future. And this is despite the funding that we can expect under COVID-19 is probably going to far surpass emergency funding from the past. There's a greater urgency given that there's the need to protect lives now rather than funding to rehabilitate livelihood after the dust settles. And, you know, contractors are probably going to be asked to do more now than they have than they have in the past. It would be naive to think that the government's going to be understanding of the challenges that contractors face now. It's, you know, contracting officers aren't going to necessarily always own up to their decisions that they make verbally or be sympathetic to non-compliance or mismanagement of funds. So like even 15 years after Katrina, we're seeing still the fallout from the fraud that's taken place. There's a lot that DOJ's learned from Katrina. The fraud that's taken place over the years with emergency funding, it has created the need for there to be task forces at the national level, at the state level, local level. You probably have seen in the news, like on a daily basis, states are creating new task forces, which have, you know, is an indication that the government has seen from the past that there's a need to coordinate effort. You need to have the vigilance now rather than just counting on things taking place later on and being able to address the fraud that's taken place in the past down the road. Typically, what the IG has done in the past is focused on phasing investigations. First, focusing on individual fraud. This is like, you know, fraud that comes from taking advantage of people now when they're most vulnerable, treatment scams, non-existent charities, malicious websites, unemployment claim fraud, and then focusing on the larger fraud later on. And that can be the procurement fraud, the reconstruction contract fraud, grant fraud. And I expect that this time around, law enforcement will also hone in, while also taking care of the individual fraud, hone in on risk areas that are specific to COVID-19 response. In my opinion, I think the main risk areas are going to be from an audit investigation standpoint, likely under three categories: procurements, services, and subcontractors. when it comes to procurements with for PPE, ventilators, beds, I see there being fraud when it comes to quality and quantity, price gouging, falsification when it comes to justifying delays and requests for exceptions. And when it comes to services, there's likely going to be a significant need for personnel. And this is for immediate health response personnel, contract medical health professionals, transport and logistics, financial services, and IT, and cybersecurity. So I see there being investigations into ghost employees and work sites. You know, we've been talking about decreased productivity. And I can see with the decreased productivity and unabsorbed overhead leading to falsification of timesheets, ghost patients, ghost loans, when it comes to the financial services that are offered, unqualified personnel, there being audits and investigations into that, falsifications when it comes to funding for federal and women-owned businesses. And, you know, with so much of the money going into direct labor costs, there's probably going to be a lot of attention paid in that area. Prime contractors, you know, are going to be working with a lot of subcontractors that are doing government work for the first time that may not be aware of all of the rules and regulations with government funding. It's going to be the prime contractor's responsibility, though, to make sure that you're building that capacity of the subcontractors and educating them. So when we've seen, you know, in the aftermath of some of these emergency responses, both on the government side and when it comes to being a contractor or representing contractors, of course, there's this allowances, false claims cases, and suspension of department actions. So while it may seem attractive and appealing to you know, with the huge insurgence of federal funding, now, you know, a theme that we've been talking about is making sure that we document things now, the challenges, the exceptions, the authorizations that are provided now for the future. And I think that what this means is that you have to be able to, you know, as we've talked about documentation being so important and Adrian talking about memorializing things, is that even if it's not required by the government when it comes to paying on invoices, this we would suggest to still maintain that documentation for supporting direct billing, for direct labor, requiring subcontractors to maintain documentation and perhaps even submit it with their invoices, making sure that they also understand that if they haven't done government contract work in the past, to shift their mindset from government contract work to government, from commercial contract work to government contract work. And also take advantage of what is available, even though some of the guidance right now is guidance rather than directives, there are some exceptions that are being provided. There's been a recent OMB guidance for grantees to perhaps have an exception to audit requirements and some other financial management requirements. This is only on a temporary basis, and it's still like brand new and pretty vague. But if there is this exception, and of course it doesn't give, it's not provided to you automatically, you have to ask for it. So those are some things that you may want to consider is applying for those exceptions now. There's also, with all of the considerations, including like the when and the how to prepare yourself for these investigations and audits, one mantra, as we've talked about, you know, throughout this presentation, is the documentation requirement and the necessity to document. This goes a long way to protect yourself for what's inevitable when it comes to the inspections, audits, and investigations in the future.
Great. Thanks, Annie. So it's helpful to hear from Annie and Adrian in particular, because as Andy mentioned, Annie is an attorney and a former OIG special investigator who spent years on the ground in Afghanistan, Iraq, Egypt, and has done numerous timekeeping fraud investigations, which are going to be significant here. And Adrian has as well, as a former OIG and DCA auditor. I'm going to take just a minute to talk about this ideal OMB memo. This is something that, as I mentioned, we put together over the weekend that we are trying to get to OMB and to people who can influence OMB. There's an imperative to continue performance from contractors so that vital government programs don't go off a cliff. And in order to do that, in my opinion, the government needs to speak much more clearly with greater direction and use the tools that they already have available to them. And they've done this before. They did it during Hurricane Katrina. They've done this in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's time for OMB to step up and create clarity around what contractors are supposed to be doing, and more importantly, what contracting agencies are supposed to be doing. So we have drafted this memo that we're going to post to the PubK website, along with the live video or the recorded video of this webinar, and the slides and the various materials we've referenced in here. We're going to include this model memo. And the model memo says things like the paid leave doesn't apply to just DOD. Agencies should be and are directed to consider COVID-related leave to be allowable and allocable so long as contractors are demonstrating that they are making best efforts to mitigate the loss of productivity. The direction should be to different agencies. You can use all of your appropriations, not just your standard appropriations, just like is found in 3610 and a number of other measures like that. I'll let you read what's online once we post that, but we're hoping to get this into the hands of OMB later today. And if they agree to it, it's going to solve a lot of problems. Andy, do you want to very quickly touch on any questions we've received?
Yeah, we've received a couple more in. Let me just run through them. So one question is, how can subcontractors address their impacts under Section 3610 to their primes? You want to take that?
Yeah, the same way that primes can address it to their contracting officers and grants officers. Memorialize all of it in the way that we've said here, flow it up to the primes, and the primes should roll it up to the government as part of their discussions with the government.
Great. And another is, would it be possible to remove the ceilings on indirect costs if you can show that the indirect costs went up due to the COVID-19 crisis?
I would be surprised if anybody's going to remove the ceilings, but I can imagine a scenario fairly easily where you can renegotiate the ceilings. And in my opinion, just about every contractor is going to have to try to do this. And so the faster you get in line for it, the better off you'll be.
So it looks like we have one more minute. And so we'll take one, the last question probably take is asking whether there's any guidance yet on whether DCAA will defer their audit activities given the shelter-in-place orders and disruptions.
Yeah. So my view is the government, just like everybody else, is struggling to figure out what to do. I believe that DCAA will proceed with their normal course load. And if they have not already done so, they'll set up a special group to focus on COVID-related audit issues. But I expect all of their regular year-end audits to be occurring simultaneously. I don't expect that to let up.
Great. Well, thank you all. So it is, we are at 1 o'clock. I think if there are additional questions that come in, we will try to respond to them back to you by email. We thank you very much for your participation. And Bill, are you closing things out?
We will have the presentation and slides up on PubK as soon as we get all the materials processed and ready, and we will send out a link to that to all participants, as well as answers to all the Q&As. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Nichols Lew team, for joining us today for this very important topic, and also thank you to all our attendees. We had a great response great response to this very important topic. And thank you very much. And that's it for our hour. And we'll let you go back to your day.
Thank you.